stage 1, stage 2, and stage 3. The reason for the magnetic field that the city's using. Stop it. This is WS2N. The reason he uses the magnetic field is that so that the argon gas, when heated to ridiculously high temperatures, 3.5 million degrees, does not touch the chamber wall. So theoretically, it could last forever. You know, I mean, this rocket engine, it won't wear out. The ion engine, they have some issues with contact with the wall, some degradation that's going on with that. And with this, he won't have that. But to qualify for his first flight, he'd like to put it on the International Space Station. He wants to put it on the One Trust section on the ISS. He uses to keep the ISS in orbit by constantly firing his Bessemer engine. Drop it. But to qualify for anything like that or any deep space mission, NASA wants him to fly this thing up for a total of at least 100 hours. He's working on that. He's managed to keep it going for quite a while. I haven't heard the latest, you know, in the last month or two on what he's gotten it up to. But he's in this big vacuum chamber. And he's got some kind of exhaust. This is down in Texas now, where it's located. He's got some kind of exhaust. Because this thing does develop a lot of heat, and it does have an exhaust. So it's a vacuum chamber. Once this thing starts firing, well, now the vacuum chamber is no longer a vacuum. And he has the ability to suck this stuff out. And that's part of his biggest challenge with his test setup, trying to get rid of the heat. But he's getting there. But it's a step in the right direction. Let me drop it. If he is able to develop this, he can put multiple systems on board to develop more power, you know, more thrust. And it would cut down the time, for instance, on a manned flight going to Mars. Part of the problem that we have sending people to Mars is the time, the radiation that adds up. Cut down, you know, 6 or 8 months down to 2 months, maybe 3 months, whatever it is. It's a lot less time, a lot less food that you have to bring. So he's got something here, and we'll see how he does. Back to you for any questions or anything, Dick. I'll be here. This is WS2N.
What makes an ionic engine so efficient is that the particles being sent out from that engine are at an extremely high velocity. I guess they're a good fraction of the speed of light. They're relativistic speeds. In the case of a chemical engine, rocket engine, the higher the temperature, the higher the pressure you can operate it at, you get more and more efficiency, so to speak. You're using less fuel to get the same amount of thrust if you can throw those particles out fast enough. So, in the case of the ionic engine, you've ionized that fuel, inert material, and then I am guessing you get the majority of the thrust by throwing out the positive ions. And the electrons that are left over, you've got to get rid of them too, otherwise you're going to accumulate a great big charge. So, I am guessing the majority of the thrust is the nucleuses of the particles, and the electrons that you freeze in order to make the plasma, you've got to accelerate those also. So how is that accomplished, Paul? Because, let me drop. If you were only accelerating the more dense particles, the nucleuses, the positively charged particles, and you're allowing the electrons to hang around, you've been building up a charge, and at some point, the charge on the rocket would be so great that the particles you shot out will turn around and come back, and you're going to lose your thrust. So how do they also get rid of the electrons in my simplistic example? WS2N, K2LIW?
Yeah, I'm suspecting this guy's going to have a problem with the Bessemer engine, too, trying to is the same thing. The drawings I've seen show, there's blue light coming out of the, exhaust for the ion engine. And, sometimes there's a sketch on how it works. And you'll see, off to the side, a small, looks like a small little tube. I don't know if it's the equivalent of a lightning rod or, it might not even be a tube. It might be solid. But very small, coming off the side of these things. In pictures and then drawings. Mostly drawings. I'm guessing the electrons are coming off of that. And as it gets a distance away from the spacecraft, I think they're recombining back to the xenon protons. Protons are what, 1,800 times more dense than electrons. So yeah, you really want to shoot the protons out. Electrons, I guess, would work too, but you need more mass. But the problem with Chang Diaz, I've asked the problem with the Bessemer engine is getting enough electricity to run these things. The highest number they figure they could run with an ion engine is 40 kilowatts. Where with the Bessemer engine, he's planning on, this one test unit that's going to run for 100 days is going to run on 100 kilowatts. Space flight, if he gets one into space, they'd like to have one running at 200 kilowatts. That's a lot of power. And that means a lot of solar energy. It's okay. Yeah, they think they can drum up enough solar energy to make, let's say, a flight here to the moon or back. Within the confines of, between here and the inner planets and maybe Mars. But preferably, if you're going to go out to Mars or beyond, with the Bessemer engine solar panel, due to the inverse square law, you're not going to get the amount of, you're going to drop off double distance, you're going to drop off four times. You're going to need four times the amount of solar panel space compared to around Earth once you get out to Mars. So that's not good. So the only answer to him, he's waiting for approval. He's got a long wait, by the way. Let me drop it. Is to have NASA approve a nuclear-powered engine. I'm talking about nuclear power in space to drive that engine. I'm not talking about naughty, radioisotope thermoelectric generator. I'm talking about nuclear power. Looking enough power to run his own NASA's already used to these ion engines, the Hall effect, ion engines. So, got that hurdle to overcome, too. They're already used to the design. They're used to now on satellites going up for station keeping. Once they're in geosynchronous orbit, they got the Hall engine on the X-37B for the military, for the Air Force, launching that vehicle. That's the one that launches, goes into orbit, stays up for a couple of years, and comes back and lands on a runway. That now has a whole engine in it as well. It's got a tough selling point. Back to you, Dick.
In order to have these really big ion engines running at 40, 100, 200 kilowatts, except for a huge solar panel and a small astronomical unit, in other words, close to Earth. I guess you can do that, although you still got an awful lot of mass to accelerate with those great big solar panels. So nuclear power would be nice. However, the nicest nuclear power that I know of that you can easily get heat out of in space is plutonium. and that's what these RTGs are running on. But to my knowledge, we're very shy on the amount of plutonium that's available to make RTGs. So if it was going to be I've got two sets of questions here, Paul. If it's going to be nuclear power, what's the fuel going to be? I'm having trouble believing it's going to be uranium-235, because to make a complete nuclear power station sounds like an awful massive project for a spacecraft. That's question number one. And question number two, as I see it, you've got to, by some means, on the ionic engine, you've got to also accelerate those electrons, hopefully in the same direction. You're not going to get as much thrust out of them, but still you've got to accelerate them away, otherwise you're going to build up a huge charge. The first 2S, K2RIW.
Yeah, well, like I said, the only answer is nuclear power in space, and I mean nuclear power, not the RTGs. RTGs are only going to put out, 103 watts per unit. We don't have too many units left, and it's going to be a long time in coming. So just to get up to 1,000 watts, the Kennedy thing, most we ever put on one spacecraft, three on Voyager. I believe New Horizon has two. Curiosity has one. And, you're only putting out 1/10 of a kilowatt. Not going to do it. But you have to have a nuclear powered station on board. And I'm trying to think of a program NASA had at one time many decades ago. They were developing a nuclear rocket. Prometheus? I'm trying to think of the God of Fire. Bad with mythology. Prometheus? One of those guys. Well, it was named after that. You can look that up and you can see that we had a nuclear program, of course. The way people are, the public. That was kind of knocked down. Let me drop it. The United States was, they stopped building a nuclear power plant decades ago. Ones that were here, they kind of left grandfathered in. That's why today we only have, 103, 109 nuclear power plants in this country. I don't think there's any new ones on the drawing board. Same holds true for the space program. Now, it didn't stop the Russians. The Russians actually built two spacecraft with nuclear power plants on board and launched them. And as a test, see how that would go. But then they stopped. Back to you.
So are you saying, Paul, in order to develop multiple kilowatts, 10, 100, 200 kilowatts, we don't know what the nuclear fuel is? And if it was a multi-kilowatt nuclear power station, they tend to be an awful big structure, and they look like they're awful heavy. So to put that in space, gee, that doesn't sound easy. Over to you, Paul.
Yeah, I've read a couple of articles. They shrunk them down, made the weight lighter. The proponents believe it's still doable, but there's no funding for nuclear power plants in space right now. I guess it would be uranium-238, probably something similar to what we have here with cooling rods or whatever. I have no idea how they would do this, but that's what they would need. Both systems, whether it was nuclear or solar, they're called SEP. SEP, solar electric propulsion. So that would be to drive a Bessemer engine. Now for nuclear, you would need NEP, we'll make our own acronym, nuclear electronic propulsion. it's a long way off. This guy might get this eventually. Localized, on the International Space Station, on the Z-1 trust structure. It could happen. He is an astronaut. He was very friendly with Charlie Baldwin. Let me drop it. He was the last administrator of the of NASA. He stepped down before the election. So he himself was a commander of the shuttle before he became a an administrator. And one of his people on board was this fellow Diaz, who now owns that asset. So he had a good contact there, but now he's out. But he's still well known. And if anybody can do it, this guy's going to do it. He's got to get it tested out in space. He's got to, once he gets that going, it'll be up to him and the next administration to convince somebody to start building a nuclear power plant that can be shot up into space and the public. They're not crazy about that. Remember when Cassini went up? There was all kinds of protests because that had a RTG on board. You can imagine what would happen, if somebody sending up a real nuke with a 238 on board. Back to you, Dick.
I see a nuclear power supply in space. Kind of troublesome, Paul. You've got these nuclear fuel rods clad in zirconium, the way it's usually done. Moderator rods that allows you to adjust the amount of power you're getting out of it. But when it comes to the ground-based nuclear power stations, the heat of the nuclear pile is boiling off a fluid like water. That steam turns a turbine. That turbine generates electricity. On top of that, it's got a very heavy containment vessel and a whole lot of shielding required. Now, this nuclear power supply on board of the spacecraft is going to need shielding, otherwise your electronics is going to be destroyed, and any human beings on board are going to be sickened. And shielding requires mass. So, for a whole bunch of reasons, a nuclear power supply doesn't give you electricity directly. It gives it to you very indirectly. It's very heavy and requires a lot of shielding. How do you get around those problems on a nuclear power supply in space, Paul? WS2N, KQIW?
I don't know. I just know that they're working on it. I have seen no details. I know there's two types of nuclear rockets that they want to build. One type, I think that was the Prometheus one, is where you would build up enough heat inside the nuclear core, again, with, you need control rods to absorb the neutrons coming off. They would have to be pulled out to some degree to create the heat. Well, instead of heating water, they want to heat hydrogen and have the hydrogen heat such an extreme temperature. And you blow the hydrogen gas out of the back of this rocket. And that's a form of propulsion that they want to develop. I believe that's similar to what the Russians were trying to do. And then the other one is to try to somehow have nuclear over electric to create actual electricity. The equipment would be enormous. I see that too, but they think that they've managed to shrink this stuff down. They'd be able to shrink it down for a spacecraft. Technically, I haven't seen enough details to talk about it. I do know that people are thinking about it. And for this guy to develop this 200 kilowatt Bessemer engine, he would need something like that for long term flight. Otherwise, he's not going to, they're not going to be able to do it. Going to have to change the public opinion.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
He can't get to the end without starting back either.
Lots of proposals to make a nuclear power supply in space have been made. It sounds like none of them have been authorized. Are any of them in the works as a study right now? We're hoping to get authorization and funding. Where does nuclear to power these great big ionic engines, where does that power supply sit right now in the cycle of study, funding, and eventually building and authorizing? Oh, you, Paul. K2RIW.
I don't know, since I haven't read anything about anybody substantially building one, except for some people discuss it as it's being built. And the answer is it's on somebody's wish list and not being funded. That's probably where they're at. Now, the one that the Russians, well, they launched two of them. I think one of them was called Cosmos, and it came down. It malfunctioned in space. It started overheat or something. Came down, I think that's the one that landed in Canada in the 1970s. I'll have to check out there. Pretty sure that was the one that landed in Canada. And it created some panic, of course. Of course, that ellipsoid area that this thing came crashing down on. It was a pointy looking thing. It was pointy at the top and came down. It looked like an inverted ice cream cone. That was the shape of the spacecraft, test vehicle. But I'll have to look more into it. I don't know. I don't know enough about the topic. Back to you, Dick. WS1.
Anybody with a sound of our voice? Have any further questions for Paul? Give me a call, there's a name right now. On the space report, K2RIW. Anything else you want to cover, Paul? Over to you, K2RIW.
We have the next launch is coming up. And there's a Soyuz rocket going up in July from Baikonur. And that's going to be launching a crew to the International Space Station. So probably later on this month. And that will be... let's see, there's five people on board. You're going to have to bring three back. Oh, wait, correction. They did that. There's three on board now. There's three on board. And so this three will be going up. We'll make it six. They'll be back to their six again. But that's the latest on that. And then there's another flight going from French Guiana. That will be on a Vega rocket. Vega rocket is one of the European Space Agency, ESA, that launches smaller rockets, and that's one of these experimental satellites that are going to be looking for testing a plasma thruster in orbit. And I don't know much about that either right now, but they're always testing new stuff. The big missions we're looking forward to is next year. There's two in particular. Naturally, the James Webb Space Telescope in September drops. That's the one I'm looking forward to as most. Get that thing up to L2 location. And the European Space Agency has an Ariane 5 rocket that you plan on launching. It's a dual orbital spacecraft called BEPI Colombo. BEPI Colombo. Named after some scientists. That developed the first one that came up with the gravitational assist ideas come out of Italy. But they plan on launching two spacecraft to Mercury. I know we had one there for a couple of years called Messenger. NASA sent one out, and that mission is now over. But BEPI Colombo has two spacecraft attached to one another. They're going to go into orbit around Mercury with some gravity. There's a couple of rockets. There's one for Earth and a seven gravitational assist to at Mercury before they go into orbit. And when they go into orbit, I was reading about an interesting system they have for separating the two rockets. You know, instead of using pneumatic pushes or springs or something, they're going to start spinning. you know, they look like they're about the same weight, you know. They're going to just start spinning, and it's going to be a spin motion, you know. It's a tropical force that's going to force these two things away when they're in orbit around Mercury. And one will be very close to the surface, doing scientific work, in a polar orbit, by the way, in a polar orbit. And same for the other one, the second one. And that's going to be mainly looking at its magnetic component in an orbital, highly elliptical orbit. But many, many years to get there. It's going to launch in 2018, and it won't get into orbit around Mercury until around 2025. So, you know, it's like a 7-year mission to do that. It's pretty amazing. Back to you, Dick.
These two spacecraft, it sounds to me like they're tethered to each other. And now the tethered spacecraft, how long is a tether? And they spin. And is the tether so long that one of them is close to Mercury and one is further away? Give me some words on that, Paul. Over to you, K2LIW.
Yeah, it's not that. They're two independent spacecraft that happen to be going up on the same rocket, on an Ariane 5 rocket, and I just saw pictures of it. You know, it just looks like one box on top of the other box, you know. No, it's not boxes, they're really like hexagons. One spacecraft on top of the other one, you know, bolted together. That's the way it looks. But, I don't know what kind of clamping mechanism they have to hold each other together. But when they get out to Mercury, they're gonna release this clamping mechanism that they have, and because they're gonna be spinning, they're like a dog bone being thrown and spun in circles. They're gonna separate. You know, once this clamp opens up, they're actually gonna wind up separating from each other. The inner one will stay into low Mercury orbit. And the other one's going to go into an ecliptic type of orbit. You know, it's going to have a high apogee and perigee. So it's complete. No, they're not going to be attached to one another. Originally, they had planned, but funding ran out for the European Space Agency. Let me drop it. They had planned a third spacecraft that was going to be attached to this whole stack, and that one was going to separate and go down and land, and that was going to be part solar, part battery operated for about 7 days, for about 1 week. And that was, they planned on landing on Mercury, but they ran out of money, so they just went with the two. Back to you, sir.
The good news is that Mercury, just like the Moon, has one face always facing toward the Sun, and one face always facing away. So I guess they're going to carefully choose a place to land on Mercury where the temperature is reasonable, because I think the temperature on the hot side is close to 1,000 degrees Fahrenheit, isn't it, Paul? And so this is the first time that something is going to land on Mercury, but not until the year 2025. Wow. And must be an awful lot of gravity assist operations in all those years of getting there. I think it's the 2018 to 2025. So that's a 7-year mission. There must be an awful lot of gravity assist flybys to get down to Mercury and then get into a polar orbit around Mercury. And then one of these spacecraft is going to land on the surface, or is that a different mission? Over you, Paul, K2LIW.
Yeah, that plan has been thrown out. That was an original plan to have three spacecraft attached, and one was going to go down to land, but they ran out of money. European Space Agency, collectively with Japan, by the way, that is involved with this, there was no more funding, so they just went with the two spacecraft. The third one, that's gone, they're not going to have a lander, unfortunately. That would have been good. So that gives you an idea of the cost of these things. You know, you're going through the trouble of going all the way out there. you know, give them another $100 million, whatever it costs to land this thing. But that's not going to happen. So, you know, we've been in orbit around Mercury with Messenger for a couple of years. And that mission is over. But now European Space Agency wants to do it. They must have 11 different instruments on one satellite, and the other one must have about 10 or 11 on the other one. One of their main goals is to investigate to see if some of the craters in the North Pole or the South Pole have water, you know, ice water in there. So I've craters. We're going to look into that. You asked me another question, but I forgot what it was.
WH4Y1.
Is that a joke?
I'm not sure if this is a question that's injectionable for this part of the space part of the TechNet, but I wanted to ask either one of you if you heard anything about something NASA's possibly starting to work on or is maybe have an idea to work on. I don't know, about some sort of asteroid deflection system. I thought I heard something in the news.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Five times the speed of a normal bullet to possibly start to deflect this thing. If we get one of these asteroids that they detect might be on a collision course with the good old planet Earth. Back to you.
Yeah, I know that story a little bit thick. Go ahead, Paul. Okay, yeah, Joe, that mission's called DART. I forgot what that acronym's for. I'll look that one up. But the DART mission has been approved. We plan on sending spacecraft out to the binary asteroid. You know, one is orbiting the other one. And the idea is to crash into one, you know, and like you said, five times the speeding bullet, you know, whatever it was. I thought they said it was going to crash at 20,000 miles per hour, something like that. But they want to hit it, and then they wanted to monitor the orbit of one around the other to see if there's some kind of a change. They don't want to do it to one that's just all by itself going in orbit around, you know, around the sun. They want to look at a slight change between the two binary asteroid systems to see if there's any kind of a change whatsoever. And if that orbit changes even a little bit, they're going to be real happy, because the idea of stopping an asteroid impacting the Earth, one of the, you know, not one of these massive ones, but a good sized one that could take out a town killer, they have city killers, they have country killers, planet killers. So I guess this would probably be, you know, maybe 100 feet diameter drop. Yeah, maybe in that category. I'll have to look what the two asteroids, you know, their sizes are. But the idea is, let's say one of these is coming toward Earth. When it intersects with the Earth, that's the problem. You know, Earth is in orbit around the sun, so are these asteroids. If the asteroid is on a collision course with us, there's only really one thing you can do with an asteroid. You can't blow it up. We've talked about that a million times. That just creates, you know, half a dozen bombs coming in at one time instead of one asteroid. And each one's probably just deadly. So the only thing you can do is either speed one up so that when it gets to the Earth's orbit, Earth is not there yet. Or you can slow down the asteroid before Earth, now this way Earth continues in its orbit, and by the time this asteroid gets there, you know, it'll be gone. You really can't make the asteroid go left or right or up and down. Let me drop it. But they're thinking if you could accelerate one or de-accelerate an asteroid, even a little bit, you know that this is going to meet the Earth, let's say, a year from now, 5 years from now. You know, and your computers have said that this is definitely going to hit Earth. You could accelerate it or slow it down, you know, and to the point where when it gets to our orbit, you know, we won't be there. Back to Dick, I guess back to Joe. WS.
Any further questions on this, Joe?
No, Paul pretty much explained it. I didn't hear all the details. I thought they were going to shoot something into the asteroid at very, very high velocity, not crash a spacecraft into an asteroid at a certain trajectory to try to monitor what it does afterwards. I didn't understand completely, but now I do. Okay.
Yeah, it's called a DOD mission. If you look at, you know, put in the DOD asteroid mission, and you'll find a whole bunch of stuff on probably the NASA site. Back to you.
I believe one of the proposals, Paul, was to use high velocity kinetic impact by taking a massive object, like they've done once before on a on an asteroid, and impacting it. That will move you into a different orbit, and hopefully you'll miss the Earth. I think that's one of the techniques that's being considered. If we ever do build a deflector, because as we study near-Earth objects, it's just a matter of time before we find one that some number of years in the future represents a threat. And if we start the corrective action early enough, very little corrective action will do the job. Now, moving at 1 meter per second in some direction faster than it was moving before, if you can do that a year ahead of time, it'll really miss. And so I think kinetic impact is one of the techniques of moving it. WS2N, K2RIW.
That's what this is. Yeah, that's what the DOT mission is. It'll be a kinetic impact type of mission. And we did it before, but it wasn't with an asteroid, it was with a comet. Tempel, what is it? Tempel 1 was the name of the comet. And it was a July 4th mission. Probably, I'm pretty sure it was 2000, or it had to be 2003. That mission, I don't know, I thought it was kind of bizarre that they had this whole thing, but it was actually two spacecraft and one that went out to Comet Tempel 1. And the one of them, you know, they separated, 24 hours before the impact. And this 800-pound contraption, it was like an 800-pound bullet, I think it was a lot of copper, very dense. Separated from the mothership, and the mothership was going to stay out. And, you know, the name of this mission was Impact, and or Deep Impact, and Impact was going to stay out, looking at the asteroid, taking pictures. The idea was to look to see what kind of a crater this thing made into the Tempel 1 after it hit the 800-pound bullet, and then. What happened was it created such a cloud when it did hit, and it was on July 4th, so I don't know, a lot of things happened on July 4th, but sure enough, there was this big cloud that came out, and the mothership was out there taking pictures, and never got one picture of how big the crater that it made, one big cloud.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
It was much dustier than they thought, so it wasn't until years later that there was another spacecraft. I believe that was Stardust. Stardust was going out to another mission to WILD-2 was the name of that comet. And I think on the way it took a picture of Tempel 1, and they finally found out it made a crater about 200 feet diameter. So they finally got their picture. But the idea was to see if, how much moisture, how much, hydrogen, or if there was any water on Tempel 1, take a picture of it. Strange mission. But yeah, we've kind of done that before. What to see if we could alter the comet speed. I think that would have been, you know, a better science mission. Back to you.
As I remember, one of those missions, after the impact, they knew it would kick up dust, and I think they use various instrumentation on board to analyze that dust to figure out what the comet is made out of. So, correct me on that one, Paul. And back on the previous subject, if we did land a spacecraft on Mercury, I presume the only reason you land on Mercury is sort of to analyze the soil on Mercury. Over to you, Paul, K2LIW. And I'll bet some of that can be done by remote sensing.
Yeah, and, you know, a lot of it already has been done with Messenger, the one that we had in orbit around that for Mercury for a couple of years. That's the question you asked about. Is this Bepi Colombo mission going to have a lot of gravity assist? And they're going to use the planet to de-accelerate this thing to the point where it will eventually drop into orbit around Mercury. We did that with Messenger as well. But this one's going to be doing a lot more. It's going to be using Venus, slowing this stuff down twice. And Earth is going to be involved in the process as well, trying to slow it down. And they're really all called gravity assists. Another 7 gravity assists by the planet Mercury itself. So it'll be doing flybys of Mercury for quite a while until eventually slows down to the point where Mercury will be able to pull it into its gravity well. That was the question you had. Back to you.
Okay, once again, anybody have any questions for Paul on the subject of space? Give me a call, that is the name right now.
WHYY. Yes, I have another one.
You've got it, Joe.
What is the typical speed of these asteroids and comets that they have been tracking so far that get somewhere near the Earth or somewhere where they got to send a spacecraft out to do something to it? What is the typical speed of these objects?
Go ahead, Paul.
Well, it's the angle that it comes in. It's highly elliptical with the Earth. We have, 10,000 different asteroids that we figured out their orbits. We've got another, 90,000 to figure out before we feel relatively safe. But some of these orbits are kind of like circular, almost going around with the Earth. But some of them are a bit elliptical. And if that's the case, it would be like almost passing directly in front of Earth as we're coming along. So it's not like, and now if there's an impact, it's not like that impact, for that. I mean, that thing might be going the same speed as all the other asteroids around the sun. You know, it might be going in, let's pick a number, 40,000 miles an hour, relative to the sun. But when it gets near Earth, I mean, if it came in directly parallel to our orbit, suddenly just got right in front of it. The Earth is moving at 66,000 miles per hour. That's what we're moving around the sun. So, I mean, you could go, your speed of this asteroid hitting the Earth could be up to 66,000. It's more like we're hitting the asteroid, not so much that the asteroid is coming at us. Back to you, Jerry.
Have we run out of questions for either ham radio or space report? Give me a call letters right now, K2LIW.
I'll throw another one your way. Are all these asteroids, or many of them that they're looking at, are they in the same plane going around the sun, say, like, if you want to look at it, call it like, what you will, the same angular plane, like the horizontally out, if you want to call it that, from the sun, orbiting in, different speeds, different distances, and so forth? Or have they ever find the objects that are completely going the other way, like, up, down, around the other way, like 90 degrees to our orbit, that type of thing?
I think there are a couple of them that are solar, kind of polar orbits as far as the solar system is concerned. But those are pretty rare. Isn't that true, Paul? WS2M, K2IW?
Yeah, a lot of these asteroids are sometimes 6-year, 8-year orbits, it was in reference to the Earth. you know, we'll come near something, maybe 20 years from now. I know there's, they have a couple of them. I'm trying to think of one name. It came near us, and then now it's going to come by in 2028. But yeah, they're all pretty much, like you said, on the plane of the rest of the solar system. And they're all, you know, asteroids. But we have comets that come in. They might come in from the same plane. They're called, like, 200-year comets. They might be coming from the Kuiper Belt we dropped. You know, that could be coming in, again, along the same plane from the Kuiper Belt. We might be able to see that one coming, and maybe we could slow that down or accelerate it before it goes around the sun and comes around the other side of the sun and hits us. You know, yeah, we're going to worry about all those, the asteroids and the comets, the asteroids and the asteroid belt that are crossing Earth's orbit, or the comets that are out in the Kuiper Belt coming near us, again, on the same plane. But the ones that are going to get you are the ones that we don't see. And like Dick said, they're coming out of the North Pole somewhere. And why are they coming out of the North Pole? Because they're the million-year cycle ones, or the 2-million-year cycle ones. They're the ones that are out in the Oort cloud. Let me drop it. The Oort cloud. O-O-R-T, I guess. That was the guy's name that came up with this. He said that, you know, the solar system, originally we were one big ball of gas, you know, and as it coalesced, started to, you know, track. A lot of it started to follow a plane because it was spinning. And some of us were ice skater pulling their arms, and, you know, everything was started to accelerate and spin faster. And everything in that area got sucked up, and they became planets. But this whole big ball of gas, a lot of it was beyond the gravity influence of this beginning of the solar system. So you had this big ball of gas surrounding the whole solar system. They call it the Oort cloud. Now, a comet out there might be sitting there happy as could be, and, you know, we could pass a nearby star, the Barnard star, or maybe Alpha Centauri, or some massive star that turns by and influences one of these comets that are sitting in the Oort cloud, and all of a sudden it starts coming toward Earth, but it might be coming from the North Pole or South Pole, and you know, it'll pass the Earth, and we won't see it again for another maybe million years time frame. They're called long duration comets. If that comes in, you get you. You know, that's coming out of the North Pole. We'll probably never see the thing coming. Back to you, Dick.
It sounds like when it comes to the search of near-Earth objects, they look primarily in the ecliptic plane. And because there's so few of them, they spend very little time looking at the polar orbit plane. That could be where one comes out of the blue. I wonder if we've got any further questions or comments. Give me a call to his name right now, K2RIW.
You sound like you want to go into the night. Yeah, one final one. With the technology that's on planet Earth, how big of something can they see at, you know, such a distance? I mean, can they see something, you know, 5 miles across, 10 miles, 15 miles across, that's like, you know, 10 million, 15 million miles away, 20 million miles away, that's, you know, heading in our direction. What's the definition of the, you know, smallest or, you know, the minimal size of something that they think they can see heading our way?
You got it, Paul. Wait for the beep.
Yeah, it depends if they, you know, they spend years looking for the stuff, and whether or not they can see it, it depends on whether or not they think it's there sometimes. That's the hard part. So they're constantly looking at the background light, the stars, and they're taking pictures of the computers, they're analyzing movement. If they see some kind of movement, they they'll chalk it up as another asteroid, you know, and then add up to list tens of thousands of these things in, like, near-Earth orbit, near-Earth asteroids. That could be a problem. And is the size, I don't know the size. Interestingly, you know, this New Horizons is going out to talk about the size of what they can actually look for when they know what to look for. It's going out to a Kuiper Belt object. What do you call it? Number 69. And they plan on visiting this thing January 1st, 2019, which drops. They're trying to figure out the exact size. They think it's around 30 miles in diameter. This thing is way out, you know, it's way out beyond Pluto. Pluto is, what, 39 astronomical units. This thing is probably out around 45 or 46 astronomical, probably 45, I guess, astronomical units, something like that. And they want to find out exactly the size and whether or not, you know, the brightness of it. So they knew it was coming in front of a star, one of the millions of stars out there. And they went off to different parts of the country, of the world, the Earth. And in fact, they had one of the space telescope ones, I think Hubble was involved too, looking at where New Horizons will be going, visiting this Kuiper Belt object that's roughly 30 miles in diameter. They knew it was going in front of a star, and they were going to look at the star, and by the amount of time it passed, and they knew that was going to be 2 seconds. That's all it was going to take, 2 seconds. They were going to try to figure out what the earthbound instrument on whether or not, you know, the brightness of this object and the size, and three or four different locations around the world that they were at. Nobody saw anything, and they know it's passing in front of the star. So now they're going to get an 8-foot diameter dish antenna, 8-foot diameter telescope, and they have that in the back of a, I think it's a 747 or something. And they're bringing up to space about a month from now. They're going to try again. They know a couple of other stars it's going to go in front of. But if they're able to see that, I mean, that was, you know, to see something happen, I think that's an amazing feat. And again, it'll be like a 2 second piece of information. It'll be from the they're going to take a spectrograph picture of this thing. They might even be able to tell you what it's made of. That's pretty much it. That gives you an idea of what they might be able to see. All the way out past Pluto, something 30 miles in diameter. Back to you, Dick.
So lots of pilot instruction books on the different subjects. Some of those objects you want to see are as black as coal. So the surface brightness, what do they call that now? Albedo, something like that. That's also one of the big factors as to whether or not you see something. Isn't that true, Paul? S2N, K2IW.
Yeah, they're starting to think that it's not as bright as they thought. It's too bright, one way or the other. Maybe too bright. Brighter than they thought, and therefore they're not seeing any dimness when it goes in front of the star. And they think it might be smaller than the 30-mile diameter thing. That might be a problem, too. But with this telescope they're bringing up on a 747, they make regular flights with this NASA thing that they have. It's like the telescope, the size of a freaking Hubble, it's in the back of a, sticking out of the side of this airplane. And mission, it's called Sophia. That's the name of the mission. They're always up there looking at stuff. Constantly flying missions. So the interesting program that NASA has. So they're going to try it with that now. Back to you, Dick.
know this, Paul, or Dick would know this. What is the maximum range of any radar installation on planet Earth that can look out, past our atmosphere, out into space, and get a reliable echo of something at a distance away, depending on the size? Has that ever been determined what the maximum range really ends up being? I know you can obviously bounce stuff off the moon with radar and probably see and get an echo like something that size, but something of smaller approaching with the most powerful radar. Can you see something like at a certain distance, or is it you get to a point where if something's just too small, you can't see it?
Pappus. I just thought of it. Pappus, that's the name. And then we could talk about the radar, how Arecibo tracked Pappus.
I know they were doing radar pictures of Venus sent to the clouds. They may have done it on Mercury. In the early days, they may have done it on Mars. I don't know if they've gotten radar echoes from Jupiter. What do you think, Paul?
I don't know. I think they'd probably get overwhelmed from the interference. There's a lot of radiation coming off of Jupiter, but I don't know. I know definitely Venus. But his is Apophis. Apophis is an asteroid, a near-Earth orbiting asteroid that they thought a couple of years ago might have a chance of hitting the Earth. And they looked at it and they did the calculations and they're looking at the background stars and it didn't look too good. I mean, it had a maybe 50-50 chance of coming here. This is one of these things. I forget how big it is, but you can wipe out a town or a city with a Apophis. And they used the Arecibo radar dish in Puerto Rico, a 1,000-foot thing, diameter antenna, and they bounced signals off this Apophis. And by doing that, they knew exactly where it was in space and how fast it was moving. And then from that, they deducted that no way that it's not going to hit Earth. It's going to come near us, but it's not going to hit Earth. Next time we have to worry about it is 2028. And even then, let me drop it. With the accurate calculations that they got from Arecibo, they figured that, yeah, it's going to come close. It might even come within 20,000 miles of Earth. Within the orbits of our geosynchronous satellites, but not close enough to get caught up in the Earth's gravity well, and off it's going to go in 2028. So that Arecibo radar dish, they used it for radar in that case, put a lot of people at ease that were looking at this Apophis asteroid. Back to the U.S. one.
If we've run out of material, we could end early today. Paul, what do you think?
Oh, I can cook. My radio's starting to cook. I went down to lower power. I got up to 75 watts and I dropped down one.
I think we're going to end a little bit early. This was TechNet number 1658. That was Space Report number 258. Be kind to each other. See you guys next week. Bye-bye for now. Over to you for any final comments, Paul. WS2N, K2R, you'll be clear, but listening.
Okay, very good. We'll keep track of what's going on this week. We'll be back next week if there's any interesting developments, not only in our country, but the world with space technology. Have a good night. Joe 73, thanks for all the questions. Very well done. I tell you, you got a lot of good questions. 73, have a good week. We'll be back next week. Back to you, Dick, or Joe.
Hi, Dick.
KQRIW, you're making a repeater. He probably turned his radio up, and that's all for tonight.
Yeah, it just sounded like he wanted to get going.